And good morning and welcome to Community Voices. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Beth Fratkin. Beth's co-hosted CV for many years and is the producer of Mountain Money and also Community Voices. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, John.
We have two fascinating authors here today who will be telling us two different stories of two extremely complex individuals who dealt with moral ambiguity in their lives. Our first guest this morning is Randall Woods. Randall is the John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor at the University of Arkansas and the author of the best-selling book Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. This real-life thriller paints a portrait of a man who epitomizes the best and worst of the Central Intelligence Agency. Bill Colby may have been the ultimate patriot, but he and the agency devoted his life to often use questionable means to justify their ends. Ultimately, this is a story about how a principled man ended up participating in immoral and sometimes illegal excursions into the dark side of counterintelligence. Even though Colby died in 1996, his story is extremely relevant to the challenges that we face today as we continue to execute the war on terrorism.
And during the second half of our program, we'll be talking to Anita Raghavan. She's the author of The Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian American Elite, and The Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund. Anita is an award-winning journalist who has worked for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times Deal Book, and for Forbes. She's written a really engrossing story about how hardworking and brilliant Indian American Raghat Gupta was able to reach the pinnacle of success. The pinnacle of success as a consultant and board member of Goldman Sachs, American Airlines, and Procter & Gamble, and how he fell from grace. This generous philanthropist, this friend of Bill Clinton and the Obamas, and this role model for many Indian Americans, is currently appealing his conviction on insider trading charges. Anita Raghavan will tell us how a good guy went bad.
You're listening to Community Voices on KPCW Park City. We'll be back in a minute. Stay tuned.
Tune in to Minor Details on Saturday nights from 7 to 8 on KPCW. Join Lyndon Quill and Annika Simos while they talk about Park City High School news, updates, sports, and play music.
Hello? Hello?
Oh, we have a...
Hello?
Is my mic on?
Hello?
Yeah, Randall.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good. Let me give you a quick intro. We have Randall Woods on the line to talk about his new book, Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. Welcome to Community Voices.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And William Colby, I mean, where do you begin? World War II commando, Cold War spy. He was certainly secretive. He was also romantic. He was an effective bureaucrat. He was a truth teller. He may have been a liar at some point. He was the CIA director under Presidents Nixon and Ford, and he played, of course, a critical role in some of the most pivotal events of the 20th century. Certainly a complex man.
Yes, I think so. That he was a marvelous subject for a biography because I think he's a combination of romance and historical significance.
Yes, and... How did he get started? When he came back from World War II, he joined the CIA, which was,
right,
I believe,
right.
Just formed.
Right. His father was a career military, but also had a PhD in English literature. And although Colby came from a Catholic family, he was an only child and spent a tremendous amount of time with his father, who was fascinated by unconventional warfare, particularly during the French and Indian War. The family was, sixth generation New England, and Colby became interested in Rogers Rangers and unconventional warfare as a child. He was going to West Point, but his sight was too poor. So he went to Princeton instead, and then after World War, and then enrolled in Columbia Law School. World War II broke out. He enlisted in the regular military, but then while Bill Donovan created the OSS, the Wartime Intelligence and Covert Operations Agency for the United States, Colby was immediately drawn to it, and he joined in 43 and dropped behind German lines in both France and Norway, and was a very effective commando. His reputation as a commando would serve him well throughout the rest of his career. He returned to the U.S., got a law degree, and actually worked for Donovan's law firm. But when the CIA was founded, he was recruited and joined the CIA in 1950, and then that would be his career until he was fired as director in 1976.
Well, can you tell us exactly what or about what he did in Norway? I mean, what was his job?
Well, it was a movie called Bridge Too Far, which in part was based on his exploits. This was in 1945, after D-Day. Patton and Montgomery were driving toward Germany, and there were 140,000 German troops in Scandinavia. And the German high command was desperate to get them back to defend the Fatherland. And Colby and his commandos were charged with blowing up key bridges in Norway and keeping them bottled up so they wouldn't be a factor in the final fight. And they on two separate occasions, they blew up key bridges and succeeded in keeping this huge force bottled up. But it was Perry and the pirates, really. I mean, they fought running battles with the Germans after they blew up the bridges in low temperature. I think that not only is it a romantic story in and of itself, it had an impact on Colby in a way that he went through that experience, and he didn't learn to. He wasn't a fearless person. Nobody's fearless, but he was able to put concern for his personal safety in a kind of drawer, if you will, and he had this kind of steely courage that impressed his colleagues throughout the rest of his career.
And so later, he moves on to Italy. And what was his job there?
Yeah, he was the CIA really developed two cultures after its inception. One was traditional and involved spying and espionage, counter-espionage. But the other, which was initially largely unforeseen, focused on political and psychological warfare, covert operations, and that was Colby's specialty. He went to Italy in the 1950s, and his job was to prevent the Italian communists from taking over the country through the electoral process. So he funneled U.S. funds to Catholic parties, to the Christian Democrats, funded propaganda, and helped succeed in preventing the Italian communists from winning control of the country at the polls.
So was that considered acceptable to muddle in the affairs of a sovereign state?
It was then. It wouldn't be later. It wasn't until after the Bay of Pigs, the failure of the Bay of the Pigs, that any significant portion of the American people or press began to question CIA. In the 1950s, the CIA was regarded in very James Bond fashion as an admirable romantic weapon, very effective weapon in our struggle against Sino-Soviet imperialism. So no, it wasn't. It would be very much, as you know, later, and as disillusionment with the war in Vietnam gained momentum, the CIA, from becoming a national hero, became a national villain.
And, of course, Randall, the culture at the time was to stop communism at any cost.
Absolutely.
So they had a lot of support.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this document wasn't made public until the 1960s, but in 1953, President Eisenhower commissioned General James Doolittle of the Doolittle Raid fame to do a top-secret study on how to combat communism most effectively. And he issued this report, which was widely circulated internally, who said that we faced the most implacable enemy that we'd ever faced, which would resort to any means, any tactics to win. And if we didn't match them in their ruthlessness, we were going to lose the Cold War. And that the Doolittle Report really served as a kind of guide for the CIA throughout the 50s and 60s.
And Colby's belief in guerrilla warfare made him the perfect candidate for promotion.
Yeah, he went to his father served in China in the 1930s, and Colby was fascinated with Asia, much more so than Europe. And when the opportunity to go to Vietnam in 1959 appeared, he jumped at it. He went to Vietnam in 59 when the ZM was ZM. Noden Diem and his brother Nu were in control of South Vietnam. The country had been divided between Communist North and non-Communist South. And Colby went to South Vietnam as station chief and to help the ZMs, who were, by the way, fellow Catholics, create and maintain a non-Communist state in South Vietnam. And what he wanted to do there during his stay was to create political and military elements in the countryside. He wanted to arm and train villagers who could defend themselves, govern themselves, and he saw these as the building blocks of a non-communist Vietnam that could defend itself. And that really was. He left Vietnam to come back to the States in 62. To head the Far East Division of the CIA, which included Vietnam and Laos. And this obsession with counterinsurgency and pacification would mark his entire tenure in the CIA during the 1960s.
And we're speaking with Randall Woods, who has written a fascinating book, Shadow Warriors, William Egan Colby and the CIA. Randall, you did so much research for this book, and It's an excellent book.
Well, thank you.
Both Beth and I, really took a good look at it. And I wanted to ask you, did your impression of Bill change from when you started doing the research till the end, till when you finished?
I became interested in him because I teach a course in Vietnam, and I've written about Vietnam, and. Many people believe that, or at the time, and this was a conventional wisdom for so long in academia, that in 1968, with the Tet Offensive and Johnson's decision not to run, really that the war was over. But it continued for another 4 years. There was a shift to counterinsurgency and pacification. There was a whole history of the U.S. in Vietnam that hadn't been told, and Colby was in charge of pacification and counterinsurgency in Vietnam from 68 to 72. So that was the immediate impetus. So David Petraeus actually worked for him during that period, but I wasn't really familiar with Colby as a person. I really the CIA and. I discovered a person who was, I think fanatic is too strong a word, but he was a true believer. He wasn't a political ideologue. He didn't think there was anything wrong with democratic socialism. He was opposed to totalitarianism. He was almost Jesuitical in his commitment to his country. And his at the same time his pragmatism, his willingness to use any kind of means. Before he dropped into occupied France, he bought a copy of T.E. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and kept that book. Lawrence was one of the original counterinsurgency people in the Middle East during World War I, and he kept that book with him. until he died, really. And for him, it was a study in the lengths to which a good man will commit violent, evil deeds in a good cause. And I think that tension in him was something that I discovered as I went through the project.
Yeah, it's hard to have a lot of sympathy for this man, even though, you know, you can respect his beliefs and his patriotism and all that, yet he had no compunction about sending his own people onto the other lines, knowing that they were going to be shot
That's
down
right.
and killed, and he was responsible for the death of hundreds of Vietnamese, whether they were Viet Cong or from South Vietnam. I mean, and he had, it doesn't seem like he had any reservations about this aspect of what he was doing for a living.
Well, I think he, what makes him interesting is I do think he had a moral compass. I think he considered these questions from a moral viewpoint, and there were people in the agency who were sociopaths who really didn't weren't concerned about that. But he was able to reconcile it with his faith, whether we think that's justified or not. But yeah, the Phoenix program, which was part of counterinsurgency pacification, you know, killed probably 20,000 Viet Cong cadre, and Colby was responsible in no small part in creating a civil war in Indonesia in the 1960s, which ultimately took the lives of 300,000 people.
Yeah, and if I could ask you about that, you know, when I think about the CIA agents, I always think of these educated, top of the class recruits, you know, that may have come from, well, you know, any school, but Ivy League schools,
right?
Any school, and they certainly would fit in at Foggy Bottom as well as anywhere in American suburbia. But that's not the case necessarily. I mean, it was a fascinating read that the CIA employs some crazy people.
Right. Yeah. There are two kinds of CIA people. There are the CIA officers who you described,
mm-hmm.
and then there are contractors that they contract with to do specific jobs.
Right.
And these people are, you know, they're the Colonel Kurtz. They're the, you know, Terry and the Pirates. These people are, you know, live on the edge of civilization.
I'm thinking of Tony Poe.
Who
spent his spare time drinking like a fish and making explosive devices. And
collecting ears.
And yes, the Humong, or I don't know if I pronounced that right, patrols,
yeah.
to cut the ears off so of the nightly victims and string them on a lanyard. Not exactly the type of guy you'd want dating your daughter.
No. And there were all sorts of people like that. Now, sometimes the line between the Tony Poes and the Bill Colbys blurred. There's an interesting man named Vint Lawrence who. Very well educated, Ivy League. He went on to be a political cartoonist. He's still alive, but he was with Poe upcountry, and Colby visited Laos at one point and told Lawrence that he needed to come home because if he didn't, no matter what his background was, he was going to become Tony Poe, and so that's a, you know, that sometimes the line between the Ivy League. Eastern establishment types and the knuckle draggers, as they were called, sometimes that blurred.
Right, and just a final note on Tony. I understand that he was the model for Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You wrote that in your book,
and we all thought that was fiction.
No. It was. You know, I mean, they. You know, Apocalypse Now offers a fictionalized account of a character that is based on Tony Poe, for sure.
Right. And earlier, you had mentioned the Phoenix program where 20,000 Viet Cong were killed. But were they Viet Cong, or were they thought to be possibly sympathizers? Who were those people? Were they civilians?
They were all of those things. They were, the target was VC cadre. The Viet Cong... The heart of the insurgency in the South were these so-called VC cadre. They were combination of political and military officers who ran armed propaganda teams in the provinces and converted peasants either through indoctrination or through terror. And the Colby's operation targeted them for elimination. And in the Phoenix program, SEALs, American SEALs, trained South Vietnamese commandos using U.S. intelligence to go into these villages, identify the Viet Cong, and either capture them or kill them. Well, sometimes they identified and captured or killed a legitimate VC cadre, but in some places the process became corrupted, and the local South Vietnamese province chief might use the Phoenix personnel to settle a personal score or to extort money from wealthy villagers. So it was not completely corrupted, but in certain places it became corrupted.
Well, you certainly paint a picture of corruption in South Vietnam. South Vietnamese government.
Yes.
And Bill Colby just kept clinging to his ideas that if we fought the war his way, that we would win it. And it just seems incomprehensible to me because the evidence was just falling down all around him. We were not winning that war, and we weren't capable of it. And what was the point anyway? But then he after Vietnam falls, he comes back and is appointed the head of the CIA, and Watergate occurs, and of course we know that some of the burglars were ex-CIA people, and he goes on to reveal the family jewels. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
What they were? And
Nixon and Kissinger appointed Colby. It was unusual to appoint a career officer who wasn't a political figure. They appointed him because they thought he'd be a good soldier. He didn't have any constituency, and he'd do what they told him. Kissinger and the White House were already implicated in the process of being implicated in the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile. Something that they didn't want to come out. Nixon also he viewed the CIA as his enemy, and his first director, James Schlesinger, who Colby assisted, and then Colby were under orders to liquidate a third of the personnel at Langley, and which they did. Well, they angered these people. This was a time when the anti-war movement was reaching its peak. Congress and the press was investigating the CIA, and a lot of these fired people began cooperating with the press. So all of the former secrets about the plot to kill Castro, to kill Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, the fact that the CIA had penetrated U.S. Organizations like the National Students Union, all this began to hit the front pages. And Colby was under orders from now Ford and Kissinger to stonewall with Congress, not to tell them anything, not to confirm anything. But Colby disobeyed them. He deliberately disobeyed those orders and began cooperating with the Church Committee and other congressional committees insofar as he could. He wouldn't give them names of American agents or specifics, but he would confirm, he confirmed the assassination plots and those sorts of things. Ultimately, that caused him to be fired in 1976. But Colby believed that if he didn't cooperate with Congress in that climate, that Congress might very well eliminate the CIA, do away with the CIA, which he believed would do a vast disservice to the country's security. And he was also trained as a constitutional lawyer. He was not going to disobey a subpoena from Congress. But the community is still divided. I think intelligence people are still divided. There are those who are traditionalists who view him as a traitor. But there are also others who think that he was right, and in that climate, if he hadn't been pragmatic and compromised, that the CIA would have disappeared.
We're running out of time, but two really quick questions. One is,
sure,
what is the extent today of Congress's oversight of CIA? And then the final question, what happened to Bill? There's the questions you brought up in the beginning of the book about him dying in a suspicious way.
Well, I think that the family jewels crisis changed everything, because before that there was no effective oversight. But since then, there has been, some people say, too much oversight. But certainly the pendulum has swung in favor and in behalf of a greater oversight. Kobe died. I can't say whether he was who killed him, but it's my conviction that he was murdered. He disappeared in from his Chesapeake Bay cottage in 1996. His body was discovered a week later. The official account was that he drowned. He was out, but he was supposedly out canoeing at 8 o'clock at night. This is a 76-year-old man.
Right.
His computer was still on. The body wasn't decomposed, and I think you can say that certainly that he died under suspicious circumstances.
Well, we'd like to thank our guest this morning, Randall Woods, of author of Shadow Warrior, William Egan Colby and the CIA. A great read, a really good book.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, okay, we wish we had some more time with you.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, but first let's just do the weather. It's currently 68 degrees in Park City. Absolute beautiful day. We will have a high today of 86. Taking a peek into the future, Friday, also going to be a beautiful day, high of 87. And, well, let's go as far as the weekend. Saturday and Sunday, kind of up in the air right now. There's a 30% chance of thundershowers on both days. You're listening to Community Voices on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Did you ever wonder why a siren goes off in Old Town every night? This is Diane Foster with your weekly Park City History Bit. Lots of locals have their own theories on why the siren goes off every night, from calling home miners from the bordellos and bars to checking that everyone made it out of the mines alive. The truth, however, is more practical and nostalgic. Built in 1901, the bell tower on Main Street housed a 1,500-pound bell to alert residents and firefighters of danger. To ensure the siren worked, the fire department performed a daily check at 10 p.m., This test soon doubled as the citywide curfew for local children, and the 10 o'clock whistle was born. Although there's no longer any curfew, and an electric siren replaced the bell in 1948, you can still hear the siren sound every night at 10 p.m.
This Park City History Bit is brought to you by the Park City Museum, where you can explore Park City history every day on Main Street. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
Welcome back to Community Voices. We were just talking to Randall Woods, author of Shadow Warrior. It was about the complex and spooky, truly spooky life of William Colby, the former director of the CIA. I highly recommend that book. Now we have Anita Raghavan calling in from London to talk about an equally tragic story called The Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise and the rise of the American Indian elite and the fall of the Galleon hedge fund. Welcome to Community Voices, Anita.
Thank you, Beth.
Can you start by telling us why you were so attracted to the story to begin with?
Sure. I happen to be Indian, and I grew up part of the time in the United States, and my father came in 1958. He was one of the earliest immigrants of the recent wave of Indian immigrants to the United States. And so I was very interested in this story because I was wondering why men like Rajat Gupta, who's a central character in my book, who had so much promise and had done so well in the United States, why someone in the seventh decade of his life strayed from the straight and narrow path. And as I delved into this story and talked to Gupta's friends and got to know more about him, his life experience in a way mirrored my father's, and his family reminded me a lot of my own.
Okay. Well, can you give our listeners an overview of Raj's background and his career?
You mean Rajaratnam, the hedge fund manager at Galleon, or Rajat Gupta, the McKinsey chairman? Which you mean Rajaratnam?
Yes.
Rajaratnam was Sri Lankan. He was born in Colombo. Unlike Rajat Gupta, who's the primary protagonist, he came from a more affluent family, was sent to boarding school in England, of all places, as a teenager, and then came in the early 1980s to the Wharton School, where he was part of an early generation of South Asian immigrants who were coming in increasing numbers to the United States to study, particularly finance. And he joined Chase soon after he graduated, and then was enamored by the stock market and moved on to a firm that was on the fringes of Wall Street called Needham & Company. And, of course, a decade later set off on his own to start the Galleon Group. And he was a very seductive character, someone who could get very disparate people to do all sorts of things for him, like give him inside information.
Yeah, and what about Gupta? Gupta?
Sure. Rajat Gupta was very different from Rajaratnam. And I think this is another thing that I was fascinated by as I started to delve into this story. I wanted to know why would someone like Gupta, who was a statesman-like individual whose friends were people like President Bill Clinton and Kofi Annan and Bill Gates, why someone like him would hang out with a off-color, brash hedge fund trader like Rajaratnam?
Who was kind of sleazy.
What?
Who was kind of sleazy.
That's right. I mean, there's this wonderful anecdote in the book, I think, The Billionaire's Apprentice, where Rajaratnam is out with a couple of clients, and invariably the conversation turns to women. And Raj tells these clients, whom he was seeking money from, what he likes to do with women. And he says, "I like to spank them." And then he gestures with his hand, showing a spanking motion. And, you know, this is something that someone like Rajat Gupta, who always was so tastefully dressed, so well-spoken, would be entirely uncomfortable with. And so what brought these two very different bedfellows into the same bed?
Well, he was certainly attracted to him in some sense as a, I don't know, an alter ego or something, I would guess. What were your conclusions?
Well, you're right. You know, I think what Rajat Gupta saw in Rajaratnam, particularly after he stepped down from the helm of McKinsey in 2003, is someone who could help him remake himself in his sort of second career, if you will, after consulting. Rajat Gupta was always fascinated with investing. And he made it known that after he retired from McKinsey as an active partner, he wanted to get into the money management game. And I believe he saw Rajaratnam with his billion to his name, his success in building Galleon from the ground up, as someone who could help him realize his dream.
And there are so many fall from grace stories where the culprit was greed, and mm-hmm. it just it's just a very powerful emotion. Do you believe it was greed that did these gentlemen in?
Well, I think it was also for Rajat Gupta. I think in the world that we live in today, wealth is synonymous with power, and he may not have necessarily needed the extra zeros, but he saw the extra zeros as a way of cementing his role as a power player. And I think it's very interesting that Rajat Gupta only gets very close to Rajaratnam after he leaves McKinsey. Before that, I think the principles and the values of McKinsey guided Gupta. But after he steps down from the helm of the firm and then retires in late 2005, he no longer has that anchor. And the only thing that he can latch onto that establishes that he's an important power player is money.
Well, yeah, I think it would be useful for our listeners to, I mean, throughout the book, you kind of intertwine the story of Indian American immigrants into your explanation, I guess, of how these men developed their character and what they ended up doing that was ultimately bad. but can you describe for our listeners how driven these people were?
Sure. I mean, if you think of Rajat Gupta, he grew up, he's born in Calcutta, grew up in New Delhi, came from a very modest family. His father was a freedom fighter turned journalist. His mother was a teacher. And he was orphaned before he was even 18. And in a talk he gave at Columbia, he said, you know, if his mother had not been smarter and put some money away, he and his siblings would have been starving after his parents died. So he really came from a very modest background, yet he had the vision to leave India after he graduated from the very famous Indian Institute of Technology in Delhi. And he applied to Harvard Business School and got a scholarship. And he made the journey, much like my father had in 1958, to the United States, stopping off in Amsterdam and London on the way. And he got to America in 1971 when the United States was becoming more open to immigration. And he managed to not only join McKinsey and do well there, but get elected to the position of managing director not just once, but three times. And he did this all the way back in 1994. And it's hard to imagine today because there's so many Indian Americans who are in positions of power. But back in 1994, I remember I was sitting at the Wall Street Journal when the press release about his election came past my desk. And I felt a sense of pride because he was a real pioneer.
So do you think that kind of emotion had something to do with his relationship with Raj?
With Raj?
Yeah.
Well, I think he definitely connected with Raj on an ethnic level. They were both immigrants. They both had seen Wall Street at a time when it was largely white. And on some level, I don't think they even needed to articulate this, but they knew the struggle they had both gone through to get to where they were.
Yeah, interesting. So can we fast forward to what ultimately happened between the two of them and to the trading company?
Sure. The core of the government's case at trial last year was that Rajat Gupta had given Rajaratnam inside information on a couple of companies, notably Goldman Sachs and Procter & Gamble. And the Goldman Sachs charges were the most devastating. One of them related to a Goldman board meeting that Gupta attended on September the 23rd, 2008, which was at the height of the financial crisis. And the government said that a minute after Gupta got off the Goldman board call, he picked up the phone, called Rajaratnam. We don't know what the two said together because the call was not wiretapped. It was on Raj's work phone, which was not being recorded. But what we do know is that soon after the call, seconds after the call, Galleon, Raj's hedge fund, puts together a big order to buy Goldman Sachs stock, which, of course, rose on the news of the Warren Buffett investment. So that was really the core of the government's case, the tipping on Goldman Sachs, where Rajat Gupta was a board member. And throughout the trial, of course, Gupta denied the allegations, said why would he have tipped off Rajaratnam when, in fact, he was in a dispute with his former business partner at the time of the alleged call. So, real difference of opinion there between the government and the defendant.
Did he ever, was he ever compensated directly? Did he ever benefit from any of these tips that he gave his former business partner?
That's a very good point. No, there was no cash in suitcases, a la the insider trading case involving a former Kidder Peabody banker named Marty Siegel. There wasn't even payments through bank accounts as there was in the case of Rajat Gupta's protege at McKinsey, Anil Kumar, who was also swept up in this case. The government was able to show benefit by suggesting that because Gupta was invested in a number of Galleon funds, because he had shared business interests with Rajaratnam, he was in a position to benefit.
Benefit indirectly, sure.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, again, it was rumors of a – well, in the board meeting, they discussed that Warren Buffett was had intended to put $5 billion into Goldman, and that in turn led to the phone call, and then, of course – the investment of $25 million in Goldman. It's a lot of money.
Right, right. No, if you look at just the circumstantial evidence, it's very powerful. And during Rajat Gupta's appeal hearing, actually, one of the appeals court judges asked his lawyer, "Are you telling me this was all coincidence?"
Yeah, that's
so what is the current status of the appeal of the investigation?
Well, the appeal of Rajat Gupta is still pending, but late last month a three-person panel of judges in the Second Circuit ruled on Rajaratnam's appeal of the wiretap recordings. Rajaratnam had said the wiretaps were essentially unlawful. And the panel of judges came back and said, no, they weren't. And, in fact, went one step further than the district court and said that the government had not submitted any material information, particularly about a parallel SEC investigation, with a reckless disregard of the truth when it made its application. Rajaratnam's lawyers had been saying that this omission had been made with a disregard for the truth. So this was a resounding victory for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan.
The U.S. Attorney's Office has been pretty aggressive lately. It seems like every day I open the newspaper, or more accurately, look at the web and find out about another investigation like this. Is was it just, I mean, is this an epidemic?
Well, I think what you're talking about, Beth, is opening up the papers today and learning that the U.S. government, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan in particular, has indicted SAC Capital, which is widely viewed as one of the most successful hedge funds around, run by the enigmatic Stephen A. Cohen, from which it takes its name. And I think the indictment you see today and all of the cases that we've seen over the last couple years have actually been rooted in this investigation that I wrote about in The Billionaire's Apprentice, the Galleon investigation. The first inkling that the feds had that there might be something suspicious at SAC, they'd heard rumors over the years, but the first real inkling they had was when they saw some suspicious instant messages between Raj's kid brother, Rangan, and an SAC trader. So I think insider trading certainly has been pretty widespread on Wall Street. I suspect it's less common today than it was 4 years ago.
Well, what do you think was responsible for this sort of outbreak? Was it the economic situation in 2007 or 8?
Well, I think that certainly exacerbated it. And if you've listened to a lot of the wiretaps, as I have, you get a real sense of how tough it was for anyone managing money in the fall of 2008. At one point on one of the taps, you know, Rajaratnam says, he feels like he's fighting Muhammad Ali. You know, every day he's going into the ring and he's getting beaten up, basically. But I don't think it was just the economic situation. I think you have to look back, actually, to 2000 when the SEC passed an important rule called Regulation FD, which is short for Regulation Full Disclosure. And that essentially leveled the playing field for all investors. So companies could no longer get together a group of institutional investors or analysts and give them a heads up about an exciting new product that was going to transform the way they do business or give them a general steer on earnings. That was a no-no going forward. And I think that made it a lot harder for hedge funds like Rajaratnam's, which seek to exploit market inefficiencies. It made it a lot harder for them to have an edge. And in efficient markets, the best way to have an edge to have inside information.
Right.
But that's cheating.
Yeah, so that's right.
So I'm not sure. It could be the tip of the iceberg. There seems to be a mentality on Wall Street that people can do what they want to do, and not that many people have gone to jail. So I wanted to ask you, you rely a lot on interviews with Jeffrey Skilling, the former CEO of Enron. Why do you think he's a credible source?
Well, you know, a lot of people at McKinsey who knew Rajat Gupta, remember, it was the McKinsey partners who elected Rajat Gupta to the helm of the firm, not just once, but three times, okay?
Yeah.
A lot of these same people in 2012 and 2011 weren't feeling so positive about Rajat Gupta. I suspect they were embarrassed by their own decision. What I did with Jeffrey Skilling is I interviewed him extensively, but any of the facts that were presented by him in quotes, like he talked a lot about McKinsey during the 1970s and how it was going through a very perilous period. And how Ron Daniel revitalized the firm, any of those facts, I actually fact-checked with McKinsey without telling them it was Jeffrey Skilling who was saying it.
Yeah,
And I also bounced it off other people. So I do think he was credible, and I think it was important to have someone like Jeff explain why the partnership voted in Rajat Gupta, an unknown consultant from Calcutta, India, in 1994. No one was willing to stand up and say that in 2012. And Jeffrey Skilling was the only one who would do that.
Yeah, well, he certainly was an interesting guy. We were just wondering how much you relied on that, but obviously you fact-checked that.
Right.
And
he's very eloquent, you know, clearly a super smart guy. And there was nothing he said that was, you know, not supported by others, to be honest, on background.
So we're almost out of time. I wonder, you know, is there a moral to this story?
Well, I think the moral is sort of the age-old moral that while ambition is a great thing and it strives, I mean, it leads all of us to strive and do better, excessive ambition and overreaching can be your undoing.
Yeah. Anita, your book is very well researched and a good read. What is next for you? What are you doing now?
Well, I'm going to take some holiday, John. I'm about to go off tomorrow to India, actually.
Oh, good.
You know, I'm going to do a little more. I'm going to do some lighter writing in the short term, and I have an idea for another book. I'm discussing it right now with my editors, and we'll see where we come out.
Well, best of luck to you, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, John. Thank you, Beth.
Okay. Well, we want to thank Randall Woods and Anita Raghavan for these fascinating conversations this morning. We also want to thank our sponsors, 350 Main and the Spur, Albion Financial Group, San Francisco Design, and, of course, Prudential Real Estate. You've been listening to Community Voices on KPCW Park City. NPR News is next.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Summer's here!
Shh! Summer's where? Wait, Jan, it's here? Uh-oh. Don't tell anybody about Park City's summer secrets.
It's a secret? But John, isn't that our job, telling Park City who's got savory summer snacks and where the sizzle and fun is?
Secrets out for summer. Find out what all the cool kids are up to this summer. Tune in to Fun Friday at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by the Summit County Fair,
All Seasons Adventures,
Park Silly Sunday Market,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
and the Homestead Resort.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Okay, as it turns out, we have just a little bit of time, so we're going to do the weather again. Currently 68 degrees under sunny skies in Park City. Today, mostly sunny, high of 86. Tonight, mostly clear, low of 53. Looking out into the future, Friday, going to be a beautiful day, mostly sunny with a high of 87. And let's take it through the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. A little iffy at this point with the National Weather Service stating a 30% chance of thundershowers on Saturday and on Sunday. And I want to thank my co-host Beth Fratkin, two authors, two gentlemen, serious big time fall from grace.
This was fascinating. These books for me, I really enjoyed them. I hope you all go out and check them out of the library or go to Dolly's and buy them or any other bookstore, and I think you'd be equally fascinated, too.